Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Angela Balassi. Dialect is Bristol's first podcast, set up with a grant from Scarman Trust in 2002 and goes out every Monday morning at 11am here on BCFM 93.2. This week, we'll be speaking to a woman who spent £30,000 on IVF, only to get pregnant naturally at the age of 45. We'll also be talking about the Middle East to a vicar who's banned from talking about the Middle East. The recording is taken from before the ban. And how to hear one of Britain's rarest birds on Somerset levels. Dialect is produced by volunteers. If you would like to join in, contact Volunteering Bristol, which is just off Queen Square. You can call them on 0117 989 7733 or visit them on the web at bristolvolunteers.org.uk. And I'll repeat those details at the end of the show. A 45-year-old woman has become pregnant naturally after an almost 10-year battle with infertility. Liz Walton had tried six rounds of in vitro fertilisation, IVF, and spent around £30,000 trying to conceive. So she was stunned to learn that she'd got pregnant naturally, despite doctors saying the couple could not have children without medical intervention. Liz now offers counselling and coaching for other couples struggling to conceive. Thank you, Liz, for joining us, and congratulations. After all this time trying to have children, how did you feel when you finally learnt you'd got pregnant?
Oh, thanks ever so much. So, yes, it's been quite a journey. And then to hear that I was pregnant, to be fair, I was completely shocked. I mean, I just assumed I must be going into menopause. I just wouldn't believe what my little machine was telling me that I was pregnant. So I assumed it was faulty. So I had three or four different tests and then eventually went to the doctor. And then when the doctor actually confirmed it, I thought, right, well, I must be pregnant. So, yes, it took me a while to get my head around it.
And when are you due?
I've been told I'm due around July the 20th.
Great. But you had previously struggled with infertility. Do you know why?
Well, medically, I was told there was nothing wrong with me. So I then had to look at what else could it be. So I then had to look at what was going on inside. So emotionally, physically, I know I was getting really stressed because I couldn't have what everyone else seemed to be having so easily. So I then looked inside and, you know, looked for self-improvement there. But we also knew and learned that my husband had anti-sperm antibodies, which can cause the sperm to stick together. This also reduces movement, preventing the egg from being fertilized. Hence, they always said we had to have intervention. And, of course, with my age, all the chances decreased. And then we were told the chances of conceiving with treatment was still less than 5. And every year as I got older, that meant that it decreased even more.
And what is it like wanting to have children so badly but not being able to?
Oh, yeah, that's a difficult one. So with my journey, you know, I've been a journey over 8 years. I had 6 courses of IVF, all of them which were negative and didn't work. What I realized, you just kind of go through a bit of madness. It's so difficult and so tough for everybody. You go through just this heightened awareness of emotions. Now, you know there's lots of people that get pregnant all the time and lots of people have kids, but for some reason this is heightened to such an extent. And all you can see is where you're going wrong, where you haven't done it. So everywhere around you is just a reminder, with people getting pregnant, with people having kids and looking so joyful, you know, what you can't do. So, it gets so tough, so emotional. And each time it failed, you know, I'm like, oh, I'm fine. And yet, you know, that lack of self-worth comes in. Why can't I do it? I'm doing everything I can. You know, what's wrong with me? You know, what am I not doing? What am I not doing right?
And so But at the same time, you and Greg did get pregnant, so presumably it wasn't completely down to medical reasons. Why do you think it worked when it did?
Why did it work when it did? Now, that's a good question. Well, I would say when we decided to sort of close that door and let go, we began quite a journey of healing, really. The blame game stopped. My anger stopped. And we learned to really enjoy each other's company, learn to meet in the middle again, have fun again. And, you know, from, say, closing the door to us eventually getting pregnant was sort of 3.5 to 4 years. So a lot of change happened. I mean, I continued to look into myself because I wanted to be someone that really enjoyed life, not constantly look at something that I couldn't have.
And what advice would you give to people trying to conceive?
To start before you're ready, basically. There's so many hormones that are racing around. And when we start and it doesn't work, it causes more stress or more distress within the body. When the body perceives any danger, any stress, it shuts down a whole reproductive system. So it's like having an internal chastity belt on. And the more that we can relax and get a healthier sort of journey in our fertility journey, then allows us to get the pregnancy that we want, the child that we want. You know, and the work that I do with a lot of my clients is about, it's still going to be a tough journey, but if we can help the mind to be as stress-free and as happy as it can, then that's going to help support the individual so that they can get what they want. And to date, so far, I've had 100% success with everyone that's come to see me.
That's fantastic. And what is the coaching and counselling? What does it involve?
Well, for everyone that's different, the best thing is if someone gives me a call and they come and meet me and we have a chat face to face. But it's about getting to the root of the problem and being able to unravel that, learn to come to forgiveness, to completion, and whatever, and basically let go of the blocks
that
have been there.
What kind of blocks could there be?
Well, again, for everybody that's different, but I had one such client, and she had, you know, real issues with the family and family intolerance and stuff going on with parents and family, and it caused so much distress and unhappiness from when she was a little girl growing up that this has unconsciously created such a block within her body. And by coming to forgiveness, to healing, to realization, awareness, letting go of those blocks, this then allowed her to get what she wanted, and which was the pregnancy she so loved.
Great. Currently, there's one round of IVF treatment allowed on the NHS if you live in Bristol, and this is restricted to women under 40. What are your thoughts on this?
Oh, wow. This is a difficult one because, you know, I appreciate in the NHS resources are limited. And, you know, this isn't necessarily life-threatening. We're dealing with huge emotional stuff and, you know, well-being of an individual. So personally, yes, I feel there should be more. I have few friends and clients currently doing their free round. And, you know, it's full on, it's tough. I know for me, because I was older as well, you know, I was told, oh, it won't work on the first one, you know, it might work on the second, you know, who knows. And for me, when I came back to the UK, because I was living in Australia before, because I was over 40, it had to be self-funded. So for each one, each IVF round, I mean, I was looking between $5,000 to $8,000 for one round. I mean, and that's a lot of money and a lot of pressure that can be put on people. And that's not even going towards trying to find, you know, trying to get a little baby. So it creates a lot of stress. But yes.
And to summarize, it could be aided by letting go of the stress, in fact, as you've pointed out.
Yeah, by looking at the emotional factors, the stress that's underneath all that. That can only help by being let go. You know, when we let go of the stress, the dis-ease within the body that could be underneath, that's going to aid and help the individual to get exactly what they want. Absolutely.
Oh, thank you, Liz. Just to let you know, Liz runs Liz Walton Therapies and Coaching in Homefield Road, Salford. And for more information, visit lizwalton.org/ or call 07986 869 547. Thank you again, Liz.
Thank you so much too.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk. UK.
Dialect's Tony Gosling has been to the Somerset Levels to take a look at some of the wild birds that turn up at this time of year with a unique wetland habitat. Hello, Tony.
Hi, Angela.
Could you tell me what's the attraction of the Somerset Levels?
Well, first of all, I'll tell you what I had tucked under my arm, which is a decent set of binoculars, because it's almost pointless going down to the levels and into the bird hides and that sort of thing without them, because what you'll find is other people around will say, there's an osprey, or something really rare around. And if you haven't got your bins with you, your binoculars, you won't be able to see it because often it's quite, you know, quite distant. But it's a pretty unique habitat we've got, and it's very close to us. I mean, literally, you know, 40 minutes by car. The only problem, of course, is it's difficult to get down there by public transport. It really, it's more like a day trip if you have to go on public transport because the there's no railway station at Glastonbury Wells, so you have to get the bus from the central bus station here in Bristol. But it's well worth a trip, especially now the spring's here, because the birds are in the nesting season and the mating season. And there is it's the only chance really during the year that you get to hear the bittern. It's one of the particular things which I heard just today while I was down there, and it's a pretty unique experience because this bird, I mean, it's a pretty nondescript looking thing, but you just never see them and very, very rarely hear them. They've got a very distinctive sound, a very distinctive call. Now, it's not just the bitterns, there's all sorts. I mean, we're talking about egrets. You never see an egret anywhere near the city. The herons, you might see one occasionally on the Avon, for example. But there's some incredible birds that you would never normally see in the wild.
And you say the bittern has a unique call. Could you describe that?
Well, I could try. And actually, earlier on today, I heard it three or four times. And I actually wasn't sure what it was. You know, I've never heard a bird that calls like it. It went a bit like this. And would you believe that actually a bird that makes that sound? What they do is they nest and they sit in the reeds, so you very rarely see them. Occasionally you might see one flying, zipping across, but you almost never get a chance to photograph it or get a proper look at it because they just live in they're incredibly solitary, although it might be two or three of them, but they stay well away from anywhere where, you know, you as a passerby is ever likely to see them. But they're down there at the moment, they're making these calls, and if you've never heard a bittern, it's a good reason to take, and also the kids will love it, you know, trying to hear these things. And I know I was just sitting around for about 15 minutes down at Chapwick. Well, it's called Chapwick Heath. It's a kind of centre down there, and heard it several times within a quarter of an hour. So you just have to sit, be quiet, and you can hear the thing. It might sound a bit boring just hearing a bird, but then there's loads and loads of other stuff to see and do down there. It's also very peaceful because the whole area once was flooded. And one of the other things worth seeing down there is something called the Sweet Track, which was an amazing bit of history discovered back in the 1970s.
Okay. And what did they discover?
Well, what they discovered was that thousands of years BC, now this is what's called megalithic times. This is about as far back as we ever know. I mean, basically hunter-gatherers were. But what they were doing is they were building a way to get across the marshes, because they did build boats, but I guess the boats were very, very time consuming to make. They decided we're going to make some kind of bridge, a very early bridge, and it's the earliest ever discovered apparently in the whole world. And what they did is they got bits of the trees, because the whole area, a lot of it anyway, was covered by trees and it was cleared by megalithic man. So they get some straight branches from those trees, some of them very big ones, and then they put them, cross them and put them in, stick them into the ground with a kind of V shape coming out from the marsh. And then on top of that, they would put a kind of trackway on top, using planks of wood or bits of tree or several bits of tree, so they could walk along the track. And that was discovered only in 1970 by, I think, somebody called Sweet, who lived down there. And it's a really gorgeous area to look around, and that's where you have every good chance over the next couple of weeks of hearing a bittern.
Okay, I understand the Hawk and Owl Trust at Chapwick was originally founded or set up in 1969 to save the peregrine, but today it conserves all types of wild birds of prey. What other highlights are there to see there?
Well, I've personally several times seen marsh harriers down there. Now, they're amazing things to watch. They're enormous, and they hover, they sweat. In fact, I'm trying to think what type of bird it was. That's right, I think it was a heron. the marsh harrier was coming near to the heron's nest, and so the heron started to attack a marsh harrier. Now, you never normally see this sort of thing. It was like almost like a World War II dogfight between a Spitfire and a Messerschmitt going on between the heron and that a marsh harrier, and the heron was successfully keeping the marsh harrier away from its nest. But, you know, that's the sort of thing that you like to see down there. It's very, very rare you'll see any of these types of birds unless you actually make the effort to make it down there. The other thing to mention is it's all free. You just park up. I mean, there's no charge to go in there. They ask for donations for the leaflets and things. And there are two main places to park. One is at Shapwick Heath, where there's a limited amount of parking. And the other one is at West Hay. Now, all of these are sort of near Glastonbury, near Wedmore. So it's about a 40-minute car drive. Like I say, it's really a day trip if you go on the bus. The other thing to say is, if you're disabled, don't give up, because they've got a radar scheme down there, and you can get right into the heart of this part of the Somerset Levels, into the RSPB reserve, in your car. If you've got your special key, you can open it up and you can drive right in. Obviously, you know, able-bodied people like myself, you have to park and you have to walk. But if you are disabled and you've got one of these keys, you can just drive your car right into where these rare birds are.
And do you think you have to be an avid bird watcher to enjoy it, or can anybody?
Well, I don't think so, actually, because it's such a gorgeous environment. It's unique. You know, there's very few places in the country. It's a bit like, actually, there are the Fens in East Anglia. It's quite similar to those. And, of course, there's Slimbridge up in Gloucestershire on the River Severn, which is a similar kind of place. But the Somerset Levels is enormous, and this is probably one of the best places you can go, take the kids, you know, and family, and have a lovely day out, because maybe take a picnic, that sort of thing. Plenty of places to sit around in the sun and watch the birds, and you never know, whilst you're in the middle of your dinner or your picnic lunch, you might even hear a bittern.
And is it good to visit all year round?
Well, it's a bit grim in the winter months, but if you really, you get quite a lot of these avid bird watchers, that is, you know, usually men with camouflage, like army clothes on, with some enormous great camera with a lens about 3 feet long slung over their shoulder. They are the people that you'll see them right the way through the year in the winter as well. But, I mean, it's really a great place, great family day out in the spring and summer. And like I say, if you want to hear the bittern, get down there within the next couple of weeks.
And could you give us one final reminder of the bittern's noise? Thank you, Tony.
Okay, thanks, Angela.
The Hawk and Owl Trust is a registered charity, and you can support it by joining online. You can visit hawkandowl.org/join/.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk.
And I'm joined, it's Tony Gosling here, by Tim Phillips from Cast Iron. Hi, Tim. Welcome.
Hello.
To Dialect. Can you tell us, first of all, Cast Iron, where does the name come from?
Cast Iron is an acronym for the Cambridge and St Ives Railway Organisation. And for those of you in the West Country who aren't familiar, St Ives is a town just north of Cambridge, not
so
the one in Cornwall.
You've got this guided rail bus system up there that we're about to get here in Bristol, and I'd just love you to share with us your experience, I suppose right from the start, as to how it's been implemented and whether it's been a success down in Cambridge.
Sure, yeah, it's a guided busway. Our organisation had to become experts in guided busways quite quickly, because it's a relatively rare phenomenon throughout the world, and I'm sure your listeners understand, but I'll just make it clear anyway. What you've got is conventional buses, but with an additional bit of engineering to their wheels and to their chassis that means that you have horizontal guide wheels sticking out that are run up against curbs, so the buses run between tight curbs that keep them guided and keep them a straight line. That means basically the driver doesn't have to steer, he operates the acceleration and that, but he doesn't have to steer when he's on there, or she.
Okay, so you've got a situation where it will drive along for a while as a normal bus,
yep.
Move into one of these sort of, I imagine it's some kind of funnel, funneled into one of these guided busways, and then the driver can basically sort of put his feet up and the thing drives itself a lot more like a train or something.
Yeah, pretty much. Can't put his feet up. He's still got to use the accelerator and the brake, but he or she doesn't have to steer as such. And, you know, c- cast iron, and me personally, we don't have any problems with the principle behind it. It's where it's put and whether or not it's useful or usable in that particular situation that's the issue.
Okay, so give us a timescale. When was this first mooted and first introduced?
Well, it was way back. In around about 2000, there were these mutterings going on in Cambridgeshire because we have this particular issue in Cambridgeshire, which probably doesn't have a parallel in Bristol in quite the same way, that we have the very congested A14 road, which is runs more or less along the same corridor as this particular route. Excuse me. And there was a study undertaken by what was called CHUMS, the Cambridge and Huntingdon multimodal study, about what's the best way to move people between Cambridge, St Ives and Huntingdon. And again, you've got to look at your local circumstances to think about whether or not there's a traffic movement in a particular corridor that needs exploring. There just happened to have been a railway between Cambridge and St Ives, some years ago, that hadn't been used since the 70s, I think it was. And our group, was put together with a view to reopening the railway. And this happened basically at the same time that the County Council started promoting its plans for replacing the railway, using the railway corridor for a guided busway.
I mean, one knows with these big projects, possible cost overruns. Give us an idea of, obviously this would have been sold to the Cambridge public and the Cambridge local politicians. I wonder, did the actual implementation and the costs actually follow what was said at the beginning?
No, absolutely not. Absolutely not. We were sold, and I say we advisedly, because there was a leaflet campaign by the County Council, a statutory consultation that has to be made, went through all the people's doors, and that was being sold on a scheme that was going to cost, at that time, I think it was £62 million, something like that. I can't remember exactly, 63 it may have been. The public, if you like, were asked to comment upon that, and they were basically saying this is an awful lot cheaper than the equivalent railway, and would you like to go ahead? What happened from there is that as time went by, and the scheme was tweaked and so on and so forth, by the time it went to the public inquiry, from memory, I might be wrong, but from memory, we got up to about £80 or £90 million. The outturn cost has been something like £150 million, and there's another £36 million to be spent on remedial repairs, because basically it wasn't built properly.
So we're talking about something like, even nearly three times as much as you were originally told.
Certainly, from the political point of view, and I don't mean this party politically, but in terms of how the process works, we've been sold a pup, that's for sure. The CHUMS study that I mentioned, it's worth mentioning, because the whole point about that was that it considered the various options, and the option that it discarded, albeit we've got to allow for inflation to a certain extent, but the option that it discarded right at the beginning was the railway option, because it was going to be far too expensive at £109 million. And we've ended up spending, or we will have ended up spending, well, about £200 million, actually, in the Cambridgeshire scheme.
Now, our scheme originally was called Bus Rapid Transit, and quite a lot of criticism was built up about Bus Rapid Transit, and then it kind of changed its name to Metrobus. I wonder, do you think there's maybe an aspect here going on where when something builds up a bad name for itself and there's some criticism, that they just kind of change the name of what it's called? I mean, that's certainly one of the feelings I get here in Bristol. The Metrobus is, the idea is to sort of let's have a fresh, sweet, new idea, and hopefully people will go for that, not thinking it's that nasty old Bus Rapid Transit, which was so bad-mouthed in the years gone by.
Well, it's a good point that you make. I think that there's always politics involved in this, and I stress, not party politics, it's just the way politics works. you know, if you get somebody who's got the bit between their teeth, they've got to promote it somehow, and if it doesn't feel like it's going well, then, the goalposts start to move. You know, if it cracks like a duck and it walks like a duck, then it is a duck. There was never really any difference from the beginning to the end of the whole Cambridgeshire saga, which, effectively has been going on for 15-odd years now, between from what it was always going to be and what it ended up being, which is basically a bus. It's a bus which in certain sections runs between guideways, which segregates it from other traffic, which is fine. There's nothing wrong with that principle. But you've got to ask yourself whether in practice it's actually giving you any advantage at all. And I think in the Cambridgeshire system, at least, you have the situation where it's guided where it doesn't need to be guided because there's no competition for the space, the road space. And then it gets into the north or the south, depending which way you're coming from, urban area of Cambridge, and then it just becomes an ordinary bus.
The proof of the pudding here, though, is in the eating, isn't it? And
yeah.
How successful and well used has this been, and has it actually been reliable? That's just the number one thing, I suppose, isn't it? Is when you're waiting for one of these, you want to make sure it's going to turn up, don't you?
Well, I mean, I would always give credit to the fact that, you know, we've got a novel system, a new system. There's going to be problems. There's going to be hiccups. And, you know, if car style had won the day and we'd opened the railway, we'd have probably had all sorts of problems as well. So fair play to that. But the problem is we don't have any realistic assessment of whether or not the Cambridgeshire scheme has been a success. All we've had from the County Council, which to me is rather shabby, is a succession of statistics about how many people have ridden on the guided bus. The problem in the Cambridgeshire scheme is that large sections of what is called the busway is not guided at all. There are, throughout the centre of Cambridge itself and then north of St Ives, they're not guided buses at all, but they're calling it a system. Now, that's fair enough. I don't mind the idea of that. But the idea of bums on seats only counts people that have got on a bus that has guide wheels on it. Now, lots of those journeys will be entirely without using the guideway itself. They'll be entirely within Cambridge, or they'll be entirely north of St Ives. Other journeys on the route will be mostly not on the guideway itself. So it's a bit of a con, really, and we've got no way of knowing whether or not an equivalent integrated system between a train system, a railway system, and integrated bus services would have been better or worse. Nobody's going to be able to tell us that, and of course, to be fair, it's impossible to say that unless you had an exactly similar system somewhere else to compare it with.
Now, I imagine you've travelled on this, Tim. Is it reliable? Is it a nice ride, and does it get you there quicker?
One thing out of the way, because I often get criticised for this, I haven't travelled on it, and I haven't travelled on it simply because it doesn't go where I need it to go. For me, there have been a lot of people who've ridden on it, that's fine. What's been happening over the last year or so is the ride quality has become worse and worse and worse, and again, this is something where you'll have to think about it in terms of the Bristol situation, but in the Cambridge situation, fundamentally, there's been a poor quality build, and we are part of it, well, a large part of the section anyway, is on what you might describe as a soggy fenland. And what's basically been happening is that these massive concrete beams, 15-ton concrete beams, which are supposed to meet each other at their ends within millimetres, have basically been slipping out of position, and the ride is getting worse and worse. Another side of it, which has nothing to do with the ride as such, but it's well worth mentioning, is that you have to remember that in the Cambridgeshire situation at least, quite a lot of the parallel conventional bus services have been withdrawn. That means a lot of people have had no choice but to use the guided bus if they want to use public transport at all. So again, it's skewing and it's distorting the comparisons.
Do you think they're right to go for the decision here? Just from a professional point of view, having had lots of experience of this in Cambridge, or do you think that they should have chosen a different system, if so which?
I think the problem we have here from somebody, I'm pro-rail, but I'd just like you to know that I own a bus. Not particularly for conventional services, but I'm not anti-bus, I'm not anti-guided bus. I think the problem that we have here is that the Cambridgeshire scheme was the first of what the government at the time wanted to have as demonstration projects. Now, by definition, if you want to prove that something doesn't work, if you want to prove that something doesn't work, then you have to let those demonstration projects go through and say after the end of the project, if you like the demonstration, it's a nice idea, but actually it hasn't worked. I have a horrible feeling that Bristol is the third guinea pig after Cambridgeshire and the Luton Dunstable guided busway, and I have a horrible feeling in the sense that the three of us have become sacrificial lambs, and I think we'll see the common sense at the end of the day, and eventually somebody will say, well, we gave it a go, but it didn't work. What we'll end up being left with, I don't know. It's a mess in Cambridgeshire. It really is an engineering mess, which is a scar on the countryside and a bad legacy. How that will work out in Bristol, I really can't say.
I can tell you how it will work out in Cannes, in France, because in 2011 they'd worked with one of these Bombardier bus rapid transit systems, and in 2011 they decided to throw in the towel and to convert the entire system over to light rail, because basically it was costing far too much to maintain. I imagine one of the problems with the guided rail is it's actually quite complex, the guided bit, and if anything goes wrong along there, then the whole system breaks down. But it's unclear exactly why Cannes have decided it, but they've decided it's not working for them at all. Do you think that may happen in Cambridge?
Well, certainly in the Cambridgeshire experience, particularly over the Fenland area, there was this whole Emperor's New Clothes type side of it, because everybody's kind of forgotten that over the best part of 200 years now, railways have learned to adapt to different soil conditions and et cetera and so forth. You know, the beauty of a railway, for all the fact that it involves heavy iron bits of rail, is that they are fundamentally flexible. The guarded busway, certainly as constructed in Cambridgeshire, as I said before, with these massive 15-ton concrete beams, that's just one side. So you've got 30 tons per panel, if you like, and they have to be joined at the ends within millimetres to make the ride worthwhile. They're dead straight, these items, so when you go around a curve, you've got a slight effect that you're not going around a smooth curve. And there are other aspects as well, which is the obvious thing that a bus can carry a maximum of 70, maybe 80 people, whereas a train can be added to with carriages and with the same driver can carry hundreds and hundreds of people. So I think it is still very experimental. I think we're, to be honest with you, with guided busways, I think we're sort of at the same stage as we were with railways nearly 200 years ago. People were trying to work out where they might work and where they might be useful, and we're in an experimental stage. And as I say, I have a horrible feeling that Bristol is part of that experiment.
Okay. Well, from what you've said, Tim, the most nerve-wracking thing so far is the uplift in the costs there were over in Cambridge. And I've just been sitting working out, it looks like, I mean, if we get the same experience here, we could be paying up to £500 million for our system. You know, that is with a little under three times from what we're getting. But anyway, thanks ever so much for chatting to us today. I just wonder if you'd like to just share with us ways that people can follow up some of your continuing work on keeping an eye on what's been happening in Cambridge, because I know you've got a website at the very least.
We do have a website. It's a little bit stagnant at the moment because there's nothing much to say. They've pushed ahead with it, and it's going ahead as it is. The website is www.castiron, so that's castiron.org, and it gives you the story of where we are. And we've left it up very deliberately because what you've got there is a historical record of how this thing progressed and all the things that we were saying at the time. So it might look out of date, but we feel that website records what we said all along, and to a great extent we do feel that what we said all along has actually happened. And if there are people there in Bristol, and I have been contacted by people from Bristol before several times, if they've kept that sort of information, guys, we've said this is what's going to happen, they need to keep that evidence and keep that pushing by, because if we're all experiments, then that information is really important.
Well, all right, Tim Phillips from Castiron, thanks ever so much. And it seems to me you're slowly being proved right about what's going to happen in Cambridge. Let's hope that they get it right here in Bristol. Thanks very much for joining us on Dialect.
You're welcome. It's lovely to talk to you.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk.
So we're definitely playing presenter ping pong today here on Dialect, and now I'm interviewing Angela Balassi about one of the news stories in the city, and that is to do with these 20 mile per hour speed limit zones that we're now seeing. Well, they've been coming in for several years now. How are they being implemented? At what point will it all be, the whole city be covered, Angela?
Well, yes, it was following a pilot scheme in 2010 that in 2012 Bristol City Council voted to bring in 20 mile per hour speed limits across the whole of Bristol. The idea of this is to improve road safety, they say. They estimated the cost of implementing these zones across Bristol will be £2 million spread over 3 years. And so far, five of the eight 20 mile per hour areas, including the two pilots, have already been introduced.
Now, the idea of reducing road speeds is a great one, but I'd just like to relate an experience from London. Back in the 1980s, the Labour Mayor of London, Ken Livingstone, introduced a system called Fares Fair, along with Dave Wetzel, who was the Chair of Transport. He was actually an ex-bus driver, quite a good person to be Chair of London, Greater London Council's Transport Committee. And they introduced a system whereby there was not only, I mean, Dave's system was a travel card, which we now, you know, I don't know how we would cope in London without it. You know, what the one ticket that was you can use on a train, a bus, underground, that sort of thing. But Fares Fair was really quite a challenge, and that was that the idea of Ken Livingstone was to use the rates of Londoners to subsidise public transport, London transport, to such an extent that eventually he would make public transport completely free. That is to say, for all Londoners, and I think the idea was this was just going to be for London residents to begin with, that if they wanted to use a train in the urban part of London, or an underground train, or a bus, that they would be able to do it with a pass for free because they were paying it out of their rates. Now, of course, this is a world before council tax before the poll tax riots at the end of the 1980s, because the taxation was on property in those days, as it is still actually in Northern Ireland, funnily enough, because they couldn't implement the poll tax in Northern Ireland. People just would not pay it. And so this money then went towards subsidising public transport. Now, in the first year, they started to lower the fares towards zero. I think it was about 1983. There were something like 10-15% less serious accidents on the roads in London. So that, to me, is the best way to reduce accidents on the roads, is you start to move towards free public transport, because if it's free, people will use it and they won't use their cars so much. But anyway, this is another tactic that's been tried here in Bristol. So how's it working? Is it gonna actually reduce accidents, do you think?
Well, they are arguing that pedestrians hit by a car travelling at 20 miles per hour are far more likely to walk away than those hit at 30. Some would argue, though, that they've been introduced into busier roads where you have 30 one minute and then down to 20 another, and there doesn't seem to be clear reasoning in some areas. Where I live, for example, there are 20 mile per hour zones. It's residential, there are cars either side, it's narrow roads, and I think it makes sense there. But then just outside, it's quite a main road, quite busy, and it doesn't seem to make sense to continue the 20 mile per hour zone. And that's where the cameras are, not on the quiet residential areas where I think people need to be sticking to the speed limit.
Well, I mean, quite a lot of people have been ignoring it, haven't they, including the mayor?
Indeed. He was mocked even on Top Gear whilst it was live for speeding. And there's been a recent case as well of a pensioner who was caught doing more than the speed limit twice within a couple of minutes.
Now, £2 million is quite a lot for this. I mean, there's lots of things that could be done with that to help the needy. I mean, I'm thinking particularly about the cuts to elderly and disabled care they've been in the city. I notice as well the electric cars. There's a whole load of ports for charging electric cars that have been set up in the city at the cost of £1 million. And that £1 million, some might say it's a good investment for the future, but the fact of the matter is these ports are almost totally unused. They're gathering dust.
I think the money could be used better elsewhere. I mean, I think there's a point and a place where the 20 mile per hour zones perhaps would be useful, but I think that it's just been stretched out, and I can't really understand the reasoning behind it, and it's not that clear either. Until we know the statistics of, you know, how many lives it's potentially saved or what difference it could make, then I suppose it's difficult to say.
The other thing is how these decisions get made in the first place. I sometimes scratch my head and wonder, because I do think that the elderly, particularly infirm, and those who really can't find it very difficult to be mobile or look after themselves, and the disabled are the least able to fight for the services. And it seems that that's one of the reasons why they're being cut.
Well, yes. I mean, it says that this change was voted in by Bristol City Council, so it's not clear what consultation there was. And personally, I just remember seeing a sign saying it would be introduced, and that was that, really.
But my experience is there's a sort of almost natural top speed in Bristol city centre, and that's 10 miles an hour anyway, so I wonder whether there's any point in having 20 mile an hour limits.
Well, that's it, exactly. You can't go that, you can't travel that quickly anyway.
You can probably at 3 o'clock in the morning, you could probably whistle through at 50, but I don't advise it. A very bad idea. Anyway, Angela, thanks very much for advising us about the 20 mile an hour limits.
Okay, thank you.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk. UK.
Zionism. Now, this is an interesting phenomenon. Actually, you'll find many Freemasons are into Zionism, and some even say that it's a fundamentalist belief. Anyway, one of the UK's experts on Zionism is the Reverend Stephen Sizer from Virginia Water in Surrey, but he's banned from social media and from even mentioning the Middle East now in his services. But this interview with Stephen Sizer about Zionism was recorded by Press TV before the ban.
Many Bible-believing Christians are convinced that God blesses those nations that stand with Israel and curses those that don't. Stephen Sizer, welcome to our program.
Thank you.
This is your book, Zion's Christian Soldiers. Can you explain to us, what is Christian Zionism?
Christian Zionism is Christians who support Zionism as a political system, who believe that Zionism has its roots in the Hebrew scriptures, and that in some sense the creation of the state of Israel is the fulfillment of God's will for the Jewish people, and the best thing the rest of the world can do is see it and accept it and work with it. As a young Christian in my late teens, early 20s, I visited Israel. I wanted to view the land where Jesus lived. The land of Palestine, the Holy Land, is the fifth gospel. It's the geography, it's the history of the Bible. I wanted to learn more about my faith. It's like wanting to go to Mecca. You know, you want to go on a Hajj, you want to deepen your faith. It was very moving. But I discovered that I had inherited a script that viewed the Jews as God's chosen people and the Palestinians were a problem. They were the Philistines. They were the enemy of God's people. And therefore, I was nervous about meeting with them. We avoided them. You know, we went to the holy sites. We took our photographs. We read our Bible. We had our religious experience. And we were just a little frustrated that, you know, the Palestinians were in the way of God's will being realized for the Jewish people. But I went back a second time and a third time and a fourth time, and every time I went back, a little bit more of that romantic vision dissipated, and I began to get to know Palestinian Christians. I'd been brought up to believe all Palestinians were Muslims. The problem was between the Jews and the Muslims. But to discover a Christian, an indigenous Christian Palestinian community, was a revelation. That they'd been there for 2,000 years, that they were suffering as a result of Zionism, and they were suffering largely because the church in the West sided with Israel against the Palestinians. And I began to be troubled by that. And so I did a PhD over about a 10-year period dealing with the historical roots of the Middle East conflict, the role of the church, and discovering the roots of Christian Zionism. You know, most people don't appreciate that there are 10 times more Christian Zionists in the world than there are Jewish Zionists. Mm. That Zionism is largely a Christian political viewpoint. Oh, it's been birthed, if you like, in Christianity from the 19th century. If you read most Zionist histories, there's no mention of the role of the church played or the influence of Christians had on the development of Zionism as a political movement or its acceptance within Western political circles. But from the 1809, you find Christians actively lobbying and encouraging the Jews to go back to Palestine in the belief that this was God's will for the Jewish people and the church. And so long before Herzl came up with his slogan, "A land of no people for a people with no land," Lord Shaftesbury had come up with an expression, "A country without a people for a people without a country," 50 years earlier.
Well, let's come back to the modern world and the fact that the Zionist lobbies, as we call them, they have a lot of influence in what happens around the world. Do you agree? And what do you think is the reasons to the events which are happening specifically in the Middle East and maybe in other parts of the world?
The influence of the Zionist lobby really goes back about 100 years toward the end of the 19th century. For example, Britain was at war with Germany in the First World War, and it was a kind of a stalemate. Two sides were kind of about equal in terms of power, influence, and both sides looked to the Jews for support against the others. Ironically, 100 years earlier, Wellington and Nelson and, you know, the British leadership looked to the Jews to help them defeat Napoleon. Mm-hmm. Napoleon pulled a fast one, and Napoleon was the first world ruler to promise the Jews a homeland in 1799 because he thought the Jews would help him defeat the British. Well, as it turned out, we beat the French. But 100 years later, it was Germany v. Britain, both competing for the Jewish support. And Britain did a deal with the Zionist movement that Britain would back Zionist aspirations in Israel if the Zionists could convince the Americans to come into the First World War on the side of the British against the Germans. And that's what happened. So to some extent, British support for Zionism was payback for Zionists helping to lobby and influence the United States to come in on Britain's side in the First World War. So that lobby, if you like, has grown in significance, and the Zionist lobby has been very smart, it has been very strategic, and it has used its resources to influence the media, politicians in particular, to some extent educational circles too, to convince political leaders and general public to warm more to an Israeli perspective or a Zionist perspective than perhaps one that's more evenly balanced in the Middle East. Well, it's ironic that Zionism until the 1950s, 1960s was largely secular. It was a political movement. If you go back to the days of the kibbutzes, it came out of Eastern Europe, socialism, you know, the collective farms, pioneer movements, the parallels with the settlers in North America. But in the 60s particularly, the Zionists figured out that if they were going to galvanize U.S. support for Israel, they needed to play the religious card. And so from the 60s and 70s particularly, the Zionists encouraged the fundamentalists, the evangelicals, the mega churches, if you like, in America to come out to Israel, and they used the scriptures to encourage them to see that this in some sense was the Bible coming true. You have to remember in the 50s and 60s, the enemy was Russia, China, communism, and Israel was part of the democratic West, if you like, the bastion in the Middle East, whereas Egypt and Syria were under Soviet influence. Religious Zionism is a much more recent phenomenon. If you look at the settler movement now, it's dominated by religious settlers who believe that they are living out their Jewish faith politically. It is tragic that the suffering of the Jewish people in Europe through the Second World War in particular has led to 50, 60 years of suffering for the Palestinians. That one people who were persecuted have turned to become the persecutors of the Palestinians. I think that Europe has tolerated what Israel has done for two reasons. Guilt for the Holocaust and fear of anti-Semitism. On both counts, typically Europeans have been reluctant to criticize Israel for human rights abuses, for war crimes, for apartheid, when we've been quite willing to criticize other nations for its human rights abuses. Well, I have been free and I have expressed my views, but pretty soon you discover that if you express views critical of Israel, you do arouse criticism and opposition. And I think that's why many within the media, the BBC, journalists, mainstream newspapers, and politicians are reluctant to be critical of Israel, because they know that they will suffer the consequences.
Your first book about Christian Zionism was the first reference to Christian Zionism.
One of the first references, yes.
Yes.
It came out in around 2004. It's been published in Arabic, in Farsi by IRIB, and it deals with the historical roots of the movement, its theological agenda, its distinctive beliefs, and then its political strategy to turn those convictions into reality. So I show, for example, how there's a very clear, very simple political strategy. The first is, if you believe that the Jews are God's chosen people, you will support the Jews. You will defend Israel. You will target those critical of Israel. So you campaign politically in the White House, the Senate, Congress, Parliament, on behalf of Israel. If you believe that the Jews are God's chosen people and that God gave them the land of the Middle East, then you will support their return. You will fund the return of Jews from Russia, for example, to Israel. If you believe God gave the Jews the West Bank, the Golan, Jordan, then you will encourage the settlement movement. So you have Christian organizations that encourage churches to adopt a settlement, to fund a settlement, a Jewish settlement in the occupied territories. At the moment, the only country in the world that recognizes Jerusalem as the capital of Israel is Israel. No other country in the world recognizes Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. There are no embassies in Jerusalem. All the embassies are in Tel Aviv. There is one embassy in Jerusalem, the Christian embassy. So there is a campaign to get the United States to recognize Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. How do you do that? You simply move the U.S. embassy to Jerusalem. And if the U.S. moves its embassy to Jerusalem, everyone else will do the same. And de facto, Jerusalem becomes capital. So there are Christian organizations lobbying Congress to move the embassy to Jerusalem. The legislation has been passed on at least three occasions. The funding has been allocated. The building has been identified. But three successive presidents have refused to sign the legislation. So it's failed. The religious Zionist lobby wants to see the temple rebuilt. The problem is the Haram al-Sharif, the Dome of the Rock, is in the way. And so you find Christian groups campaigning with Jewish settlers to destroy the Dome of the Rock in order to rebuild the Jewish temple. So in its extreme form, Christian Zionism is very provocative. It is apocalyptic. It is very fundamentalist in a military sense. Very little different to ISIS or Al-Qaeda in terms of what it's prepared to support. In every generation, for hundreds if not thousands of years, there have been people who held to an apocalyptic theology. So it's not something new that extremism that believes that they will bring about God's will through violence or through force is sadly an aberration in all three monotheistic faiths. One of the leading Jewish settlers, Zionists, Gershon Salomon, says, we must have a war. The Messiah will not come by himself. We must bring him by fighting. Now, that was the position of the Zealots in the first century. They believed that as they fought, God would vindicate them. It's not that dissimilar to many of the fundamentalist groups in the Middle East today. They believe God is on their side rather than asking, am I on God's side? Am I following his revealed will in the scriptures? Or am I using God as an excuse to further my political aims? I mean, my concern is that the Jewish people are going to suffer as a consequence of, if you like, the West perpetuating this conflict in the Middle East. We talk about the two-state solution. America, Europe insists it supports the two-state solution, but we vetoed attempts at the Palestinians to gain recognition in the United Nations. If we believe in the two states, why won't we support the two states? That inconsistency is perpetuating the violence, and I believe ultimately the Jews will suffer the consequence of that. And those that are astute recognize that within Christian Zionism, the Jews are act three in a four-act play. They're not there in the end because we've had this great battle of Armageddon and only the followers of Jesus are saved and everyone else is destroyed. You know, if I was Jewish, would I really want those kinds of people supporting me? Because I realize they're using me for their theology, not mine. I go back to the roots of my faith and I go back to the scriptures and recognize that God is not a real estate agent. God, he's created this world. Everyone is equal in his sight. We're all created in his image, men and women, all nations. And his will is that we all come to recognize him and obey him, follow him, serve him. And we express that in the way that we treat others. And we express it particularly in the way that we treat the widows, the orphans, the refugees, the marginalized, the poor. All through the Hebrew scriptures and the Christian scriptures, a test of one's holiness, a test of one's faith, was how you treated others.
That was the Reverend Stephen Sizer there, author on several books on Zionism. He's been banned by the Church of England from talking about it, and also on social media and talking about the Middle East in his services. But that interview was recorded before Stephen was banned. Oh, 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 oh
It fell about the Martinmas time, the snow lay over the border. There came a troop of soldiers here to take up their winter quarters. With me right far lie the deedle-aye, the doddy-o, with me right far lie the deedle-aye. Well, they rode up and they rode down and they rode over the border. And there they met a fair pretty maiden, she was the farmer's daughter. With me right far lie the deedle-aye, the doddy-o, with me right far lie the deedle-ary. Well, they made her swear a solemn oath, with a salt tear in her eye, oh, that she would go to the quarter gates when no one would espy, oh. With me right far lie the deedle-aye, the doddy-o, with me right far lie the deedle-ary. So she has gone to her father's house, and she's dressed in soldier's clothes, oh. A brace of fine pistols are down by her side, and a nice little boy was she, oh. With me right far lie the deedle-aye, the doddy-o, with me right far lie the deedle-ary. Then she has gone to the barber shop went she, oh. She's made him cut a fine yellow hair, just as short as any dragoon, oh. With me right far lie the deedle-aye, the doddy-o, with me right far lie the deedle-ary. Then she has gone to the quarter gate, and loudly she did call, oh. Room, room, ye gentlemen, we must have lodgings all, oh. With me right far lie the deedle-aye, the doddy-o, with me right far lie the deedle-ary. Well, the quartermaster, he came out, he gave her half a crown, oh, saying, go and find lodgings for your men, for here there is no room, oh. With me right far lie the deedle-aye, the doddy-o, with me right far lie the deedle-ary. So she's gone nearer to the gates, louder she did call, oh. Room, room, ye gentlemen, we must have lodgings all, oh. With me right far lie the deedle-aye, the doddy-o, with me right far lie the deedle-ary. Well, the quartermaster, a cane came out, he gave her 18 pence, so saying, go and find lodgings for yourself, for tonight there comes a wench, oh. With me right far lie the deedle-aye, the doddy-o, with me right far lie the deedle-ary. So she's taken the cap from off of her head, the ribbon from her hair, oh. She's tied them to the quarter gates as a token that she was there, oh. With me right far lie the deedle-aye, the doddy-o, with me right far lie the deedle-ary. And she's taken the whistle from off of her belt, loudly she blew shrill, oh, saying, you're all very free with your 18 pence, but you're not for a girl at all, oh. With me right far lie the deedle-aye, the doddy-o, with me right far lie the deedle-ary. With me right far lie the deedle-aye, the doddy-o, with me right far lie the deedle-ary. Well, when they saw what she had done, they tried to have her taken, but she's clapped her spurs to her horse's side, she's rode away a maiden. With me right far lie the deedle-aye, the doddy-o, with me right far lie the deedle-ary. With me right far lie the deedle-aye, the doddy-o, with me right far. Right far lie the deedle-aye, the doddy-o, with me right far lie the deedle-ary. With me right far lie the deedle-aye, the doddy-o, with me.